Colby's vigilantes found what was left of the big man. They had heard the shooting moments before as they came up the draw. Now they stared down at the mutilated corpse of their leader and cast wary glances at the shrubbery all around. There was no one there. Whoever had killed Kurt Obermeyer was gone without a trace. They found Obermeyer's horse and hoisted the dead man across its saddle. By then, the rest of the vigilantes were there. The settlers behind him had veered off, alerted by the gunfire. Colby and some others circled around for a time, searching for sign. Then a few of them headed back toward Paradise, taking Obermeyer's body with them. Most decided to go with Colby and Tad Sands, who were itching now to get at the squatters down along the creeks and draws. By the time the sun was setting, there was no sign of the men who had been on patrol. Colby and his yellow bands made a cold meal, saddled their mounts, and headed out, but not for Paradise. Colby had read the taunting signs about horses for sale posted by A&M Land and Cattle Company at Hay Meadows Ranch. He didn't know where that was, but if it was in no man's land, it wouldn't be hard to find. Vincent Colby was tired of working for wages. It was the leaders who got rich, not the hired gunnies. Maybe when the vigilantes were through, Colby could be calling the shots. Maybe that wagon load of money and the railroad profits it represented could be his as much as the colonel's. For now, Tad Sands had proclaimed himself leader. Drifters and hard cases, most of them wanted somewhere, the night riders shrugged and accepted. One leader was no worse than another. A few, though, were gone from the gang. Two yellow rags had gone down in the aborted attack on the settlers' digs when sharpshooters opened up on them. Some others had returned to Paradise, and there were some who decided that they had seen enough of this part of the country. Discarded yellow claws marked where they had gone. Billy Chalice and Tuck Kelly didn't go directly into town. They started that way when Asa sent for them, but Billy veered off toward the east when they saw the smoke of cook fires. From a caprock bluff above Rabbit Creek, they watched as distant bands of horsemen converged in the hazy reaches beyond a settlement of squatter camps. They couldn't see much. Whatever was happening was miles away. But Tuck had an itchy feeling like spiders crawling up his neck. There was someone a whole lot closer, he felt. Someone who was looking at him. He scanned the terrain all around, but he saw nothing.
You think maybe there's someone following us, Billy?
Billy didn't even glance around. He held the tight rein and studied the lower lands ahead with slow, feral eyes. There were three distinct little valleys out there, between low crests of prairie and gentle rolling hills. The valleys all funneled down toward Rabbit Creek, and along the valleys, spaced out at intervals of a few hundred yards to half a mile, were new claims, little squalid camps where land settlers were digging in.
Look at that.
Like fleas on a hound dog. Where in the hell did they all come from? Well, hell with it. Let's go. Nothing here worth seeing.
Look at them. Just look at them. What do you suppose they got in all them little camps?
Nothing. Those people ain't got spit. They're just squatters. Let's go see Asa.
I'll bet they got women. Squatters always got women.
Come on now, Billy. Asa said to come to town. We better get. You want to buck Asa?
Billy stiffened and turned to glare at his partner. And for a moment, Tuck could almost feel his fingers going for his gun. But then the crazy bastard looked past him and pointed.
Look yonder. Look over there. That ain't Danny Dirt Farm Squaw.
Tuck turned. Below the crest where they sat, Rabbit Creek ran along through its little canyon, bordered by budding cottonwoods and willows. And just where the breaks leveled out, three riders had come into view, going northward. Though they were nearly a quarter mile away, there was no mistaking the one in the lead. Flowing copper penny hair framed her dark-eyed face, enhancing and emphasizing the fine contours that shaped the linen blouse she wore. Her wide calico skirt was hitched up over small, sturdy boots planted and worn stirrups at each flank of her blaze-faced sorrel.
Would you just look at what the fate's done sent us?
The other two riders were young farm types, a pair of raw-boned bearded beanpoles. They sat their mounts awkwardly, though the old rifles they carried seemed as comfortable to them as plow hasps.
My, oh my, we gonna have us some fun. First come, first served. But that female is mine. Whatever I leave you, you can have.
Billy, you're crazy.
What did you say?
Now, don't go getting like that, Billy. You got Ace's message, same as me. We're supposed to come right back into town on the double. Asa needs us.
Billy glared at his partner as though the words meant nothing. His eyes were wide and staring, little orbs of dark fire that seemed to burn like coals.
Come on, Billy. That's enough. Hell, I know you're riled up from laying around that shack, waiting for your butt to heal, but that's no call to go off and do something stupid. Let's find out what Asa wants. Likely you'll get all the poontang you want as soon as we get back to work.
I asked what you said, Tuck.
What?
Just now. What did you call me? Did you call me crazy?
Come on, Billy. Back off. It's just a way of talking. Damned if you ain't the contrariest critter I ever seen.
You know who used to call me crazy, Tuck? My mother did. My own mother. Can you beat that? The old bitch said I was crazy as a loon, just like you said a time or two.
Well, I'm sorry, Billy, but I...
Do you know what I did when I heard that too much, Tuck? She said that one too many times. And I took a strop knife to her. I knocked her down, then I busted open her jaw, and I cut out her damn tongue.
You killed her? You killed your own mother?
Hell no, I didn't. I let her do that herself. I staked her to a tree, with one hand just free enough to move a little. Then I laced my knife in her hand and left her there. When I went back, she slit her own throat, trying to reach her mouth because she hurt so bad. Sure enough was a sight, Tuck. It's just amazing how hard a body will try to keep from strangling on their own tongue blood.
The disgust that swept over Tuck was like sick dread. He wanted the wretch, and he felt bile rising in his throat.
Best you just mind what you say, Tuck.
The intense burning stare had receded from his eyes, but the look there now was cold as mountain thaw.
I don't want to hear that kind of talk anymore, Tuck. Now let's just follow along a ways and limber up that peep sight rifle. We're gonna pop us some squatters, and I'll have me some fun with that little gal yonder.
Tuck's skin crawled. He turned away, then felt Billy's eyes on him, like gun barrels pointing at his back. He lifted his reins. Tuck Kelly was a tough hombre, but he was genuinely afraid of his partner.
It just didn't pay to rile Billy Chalice.
He still felt that someone was nearby, watching, but he ignored it. Whoever it was couldn't be the problem Billy was. Ruth and Elijah didn't much cotton to the notion of riding up to Hay Meadows Ranch, but Becky had her mind made up. So they went. From the time they were shavers back at Rocky Top, where it had generally been known that Barlow women backed down to no man, the boys had understood that their baby sister was a case in point. They'd both been there in the dooryard the day Moss Woodard came around drunk and set to cussing outside Aunt Sadie's door, and they had witnessed the gospel truth of it when little Becky, just 9 years old, took a hay fork to the Swamp Creek man and drove him away. It was the way she was, as sweet a little girl as a body might ever see. Just don't cross the line. And stubborn, no one argued much with Becky Barlow. Even now, Ruth and Elijah weren't about to start. So when Becky came out dressed in skirts and linen, mounted up and declared that she was going up to Hay Meadows to get a better look at Jubal Mason, well, the boys just naturally strapped saddles on a pair of Leotis's horses and tagged along to keep her company. There'd been more trouble today over in the White Rocks. Horner Burleson had been by looking for Cassius. He told him how gangs of vigilantes had made a run at two claims up there, the Iverson Diggs and Pete Muller's place. Mounted patrols of settlers had driven the yellow rags away. That was only hours ago, and the boys were nervous. From the Otises, Burleson headed north. Granddaddy Cassius had gone up to Hay Meadows just the day before to visit those boys up there and dicker for some horses. He might have already started back unless he'd stayed over another night. And it was thinking about Hay Meadows, or maybe about Jubal Mason up there, that set Becky off. It wasn't much more than 10 miles up to Hay Meadows, and most of the ride would be through lands now claimed by Barlow Kin and people from Black Mesa. They could make the 10 miles by dark. As they came up through the breaks, riding behind Becky's sturdy sorrel, Rufe glanced over at his brother Elijah.
I wonder if it's really that fella Jubal Mason that Becky got dandied up for. Maybe she set her cap for Falcon McAllister and hoping to find him there.
Well, that'd be a match, all right, even for Becky. Did you see the shoulders on him? Lordy, I wouldn't want to...
Ahem, I can hear you two back there. Mr. McAllister might be a devil or a saint for all that means to me. You two are talking crazy.
Oh, then it's really Jubal Mason you're fixing to visit?
None other. And don't go making anything out of that either.
That Jubal, he must be some kind of dandy for little sis to go sweet on him like this.
Becky turned in her saddle and shot him a withering glare.
I'm not sweet on nobody. I just reckon a hospitality ought to be returned. He did probably save my life, you know.
Oh, sure. Like it's every day that you step out scrubbed and combed and wearing a dress and head out to meet some fella.
Think nothing of it, sis. It's only natural, you being of the gentle persuasion and all. I mean, there was bound to come a time when some fine gentleman jumps on you and takes your rifle away from you.
He didn't take my rifle. I just dropped it when he lit on me. I mean, getting in between me and that outlaw. I swear, Jubal Mason didn't get nothing from me but my name.
Well, you play your cards right, sis, and maybe he'll give you his to replace it.
Will you all just shut up?
Where the breaks leveled out to rolling plains, they slowed, peering northward. It was a sight to behold. All those little spatterings of new settlements spread out across three converging valleys. It seemed as though there were claims everywhere they looked. Here a limestone foundation being laid by people living out of a wagon. There a pair of tents and a stack of cottonwood timbers. Yonder a clearing yielding squares for a sod cabin. And there were other new claims beyond, out of view.
That McAllister was right. Give folks a little land and fair neighbors and they'll spring up like weeds.
Some of the claims out that way were Barlow kin, but most were not. There were people out there who'd been trying to dig gold out of Black Mesa just months ago. There were some who just drifted in from Lord knew where, and they decided to stay. The land was greening now, and full spring was here, and it was a sight to behold. They flicked their reins and headed out across the prairie, but after a minute or two, Rufe turned and looked back, frowning.
Did you get the feeling someone was back there watching us?
Elijah scanned the back trail and the rises beyond.
I don't know. Nobody there now.
As the sun lowered in the west, Becky became impatient and cut northward away from the settlements, up through the rolling, dry hills. Within a mile, they were in country as pure and pristine as any human eyes had ever seen. Sagebrush hills, low-capped rock bluffs above stands of cedar, and grass so thick and rich that pronghorns flourished on it.
Man could raise cows on this land. Some good short-horn heifers and a seed bull. Might come up with the right strong breed.
Nah, they'd just scatter. Critters won't stand to breed without water. What are you gonna do? Drive them up from that creek every day? That's the nearest water, 4 or 5 miles away, and that's where they'd go.
He pointed at a stand of salt cedar below the crest of a sage-strewn hill.
Fences and wells. There's water plenty. Just have to dig to get it.
Hard to dig a well while folks are shooting at you. What's to keep land grabbers like them vigilantes from just moving in when you settle?
It was a good question. Rufe hesitated, looking at the lonely rolling miles around him. Becky was riding out ahead, making good time as she set a course for the Hay Meadows a few miles north. Up there, away from the little valleys and their brand new settlements, the lands of no man's land seemed wild and remote and lonely. Still, the valleys above Rabbit Creek had been the same earlier in the spring when the kin began arriving to settle around Leotis's claim. Hell, all it took was decent people willing to work to make it home.
Times will change. Have a little faith, brother. We're going to see some good times out here after the bad gets swept away. It's like Falcon McAllister told Cassius. The grabbers won't stand long against settlers that have neighbors willing to... Elijah!
Rufe's horse shied and spun and danced as he fought to stay aboard. Elijah's mount hightailed it away, its saddle empty. Elijah himself lay in a heap, half hidden among the broken stubs of a clump of scrub cedar. He was dead, heart shot with a high-powered rifle. At a distance, Rufe saw Becky Sorrel just coming around. The girl stared back at him and raised her reins.
Run, Becky! Get help!
Rufe hauled his rein and turned, desperately trying to see where the shot had come from. Up on the lip of the East Mesa, something glinted in the slanting sunlight. Rufe's horse staggered and went down, blood pulsing from its neck. Rufe fell, dove, and rolled. Through the dust, he saw Becky wheeling her sorrel, holding her rifle high in one hand.
Run, Becky! Run!
The bullet struck him in the chest. He tried to stand, to shout, but there was no sound. He almost got his feet under him. Then the world spun and he pitched sideways. He sprawled on hard ground and bristles, and darkness fell on him. Becky saw the shooter, crouching silhouette at the rim of the bluff. Becky returned the shot, wishing it home with deadly accuracy. At the rim, the sniper lurched backward, dropped his gun, and doubled over. The sorrel danced around, shying at the noise, and Becky levered another round into her Henry. She tried to aim, but the sorrel shied again. Becky swung to the ground, slapped the horse away, and knelt. Atop the rim, the shooter was bent over, swaying dizzily on widespread legs, staring down at her in shock. Even 100 yards away, she could see his amazement. He swayed, coughing up gore to stain the limp yellow bandana attached to his shirt. Becky braced the rifle, sighted along it, and eased the trigger. The man on the rim seemed to hang suspended for an instant. Then he fell backward, disappearing. Becky stood, lowering her rifle, looking to where her brothers had fallen.
Oh, Lord, have mercy!
Elijah was down among shattered sage clumps. The gray-green foliage there was bright crimson from the spray of his blood. In the clearing between stands of scrub cedar, Rufe lay in pooling blood. Both of her brothers were dead. She started toward him, half blind with rage and grief. She had run a dozen paces when thick brush exploded to her left, and a mounted man surged through directly above her. The horse's shoulder hit her solidly and sent her tumbling. She was still scrambling for footing when the rider wheeled and kicked her rifle away from her. A hard fist from above collided with her skull and she fell. Then he was on her, and she felt the cuts of his knife tearing at her flesh as he cut her dress away.
No!
With a desperate heave, Becky drew herself into a tight ball, then uncoiled.
No!
Her small booted foot collided with something solid, and the drooling grin above her became a grimace of pain.
Ow, my nutsack!
Her clawed fingers struck out right into that face, going for the eye.
You damn bitch!
Her nails raked his face, her knees and fists pummeled him, but he forced her down, pulling away her bloody clothing. Billy Chalice knew about pain. With clawed fingers, he mauled her. Casting aside his knife, he went to work on her with both hands, his eyes alight with rage and lust. She felt the weight of him, smelled his stench as he bore her down. With one last desperate heave, she freed a hand, and its fingers closed on the butt of the gun at his belt. She pulled it, cocked it, and tried to turn it toward him. His hand was on her wrist then, twisted, and she felt her fingers going numb. Chalice was too strong. He forced the muzzle down and back. In blind rage, she twisted and turned the gun another way. She felt the cold steel of its muzzle at her own throat. A few miles away, Falcon McAllister was stripped to the waist and sitting on a plank table in Doc Lincecum's little sod cabin just across the Kansas line. The doctor leaned close for another look at the healing scars on the big man's back and belly.
I never seen the like. I planted corpses with less damage than you got here, Mr. McAllister. You must be about the luckiest Jasper this side of the Flint Hills. No more bleeding?
Some. Sore as hell, too.
Skin's a tough material. That's why arrows have arrowheads. Just to get through the skin. The shaft is what kills. Now, best I can figure, the bullet entered your back at an angle and was deflected. It kind of skidded on your ribs. You got a couple that are at least cracked, maybe more. Compound fracture, possibly. Because there's something inside you that isn't holding plumb.
That's all? Just loose ribs?
Well, let's hope it is. No way I can tell. But that bullet did some damage. Like an auger going through. It ricocheted along here.
Raising McAllister's arm, he drew a calloused finger along the livid bruise that still darkened his side.
It sort of like dug itself a tunnel through the subdermal tissue. Now that means it just burrowed along under the skin, but couldn't get through it until it got to your belly. And the skin's thinner there. Of course, when it did get out, it tore the hell out of the epidermal tissue. Now that's why you bled so much.
He stood back, scratching at his scruffy beard while Falcon pulled on a shirt.
Some would call it an act of God that you're still alive. The first time they brought you in here, I never thought you'd make it. It all depends on how much you wanted to live, I figured.
I guess I wanted it enough.
Well, I done some reading on that. A fella named Packard wrote a whole book on the will to live. He allows it's a natural thing in young critters, but a matter of choice when a man's grown up. Now he says a fella has to have a strong, abiding reason to hold on to life the way you did. And he says generally that comes to a man who's been ready to die, then found some reason not to. Like unfinished business that won't let him just turn loose. Something he just can't let go of. Now, did you find a reason like that, Mr. McAllister?
I guess I did. You know what happened in Colorado, what I found up there. I guess I didn't care about much anymore till I saw that. But I couldn't put that out of my mind. It reminded me of... Well, it was just one straw too many. The men who did that, they have to answer for it. And I can't let it go.
You fixing to kill someone? That won't make things right.
It's retribution, Doc. As close to justice as I can see.
Retribution. That's like hanging the thief after the stock's been stole. Don't bring the stock back.
Falcon stood, finished dressing, and put on his hat.
You're a philosopher, Doc. Not to mention a pretty fair medic. But I can't say much for your philosophy. Anyway, I'm obliged.
Generally, I doctor horses and now and then a cow. They got no use for philosophy.
How many humans have you treated?
Damn few. But skin's skin and bone's bone. And people's blood runs red just like any other critter's. Now, I'll tell you this, though. You got bone damage. And some muscle tissue and tendons just hanging by a hair inside you. Now, you stress those too much? I don't know what it'll do. Now, you ought to lay up for a spell. Take it easy and be careful. I hear things from no man's land. Hear tell there's war making up yonder. Just try not to get shot anymore, will you?
Yeah, I'll do my best.
Oh, there's someone been asking around about you. A railroad dude by the name of Wiley. He's probably over at the Franklin place by now.
Where's that?
3 miles west on the road to Hardwoodville.
Thanks.
Pap Higgins found Becky Barlow's blazed sorrel. He brought it up to Hay Meadows because Cassius was there. They went backtracking. Jubal went with him because he knew Becky's horse. It was a wide land with few clear trails. It was near midnight when they found the breaks below the bluff. They gathered there with brush torches for light, and it was a time before they sorted it all out. They found the boys, and they found the owl hoot who ambushed them, Tuck Kelly. They were all dead. Then they found Becky, or all that was left of her. Her head was blown half away, and the rest of her was horribly mutilated. No animal had done this. Not even the coyotes were so brutish. Her dress was scattered all around, torn shreds among the scrub brush.
May God have mercy on this child's sweet soul.
Mostly they stayed back after one look, not wanting to get too close. All except Jubal. He just hunkered there on his knees on the bloody soil, holding his hat in his hands. He never made a sound. One of the Higgins boys found two more strayed horses and spread the word, and Homer Smith came with his dray cart. A few others drifted in, drawn by the fires they set. Come dawn, they scouted a little more and loaded up what they could. With Cassius Barlow's rig and Homer's cart, they loaded up the bodies of the Barlow boys and tenderly laid out the mutilated corpse of the girl. Tuck Kelly was slung across the saddle of his own horse. The nearest place with decent shelter was Haymeta's ranch, so they took him there and laid him out beside the barn. They might have taken the Barlows south to bury him on Rabbit Creek, but Jubal faced him down. On a rise above the hay fields, some of the men set about digging graves, 6-foot plots for Becky and her brothers, and a shallow hole for the outlaw. Nobody noticed when Falcon McAllister rode in with another man, a wiry, thin little man with a derby hat and eyeglasses. The stranger held back, but Falcon rode right up to the barn, and after a time, some of them noticed him there. He sat atop Diablo, just looking, like he wanted to fix it all in his mind. A big blonde man on a big black horse, he looked like death fixing to happen. And those who approached him were startled at the look in his narrowed eyes.
It was the same man. Same one that did that slaughter in Colorado.
Billy Chalice. It was him. He's been hiding out at the spring place, getting over a sore butt. Him and Tuck Kelly. That's Kelly laying yonder. Looks like he done the two boys, ambushed them from a bluff, while Billy laid in wait for the girl.
You know those men?
Sorry to say I do. I wore a yellow flag for a time, but I lit out on my own. Didn't like the company I was keeping.
Jubal Mason squatted by the blanket-covered remains, holding a torn piece of dress in his hand. Now he looked up at Falcon, moisture on his streaked face.
Did we wait long enough now, Mr. McAllister? Is that what we were waiting for it all to happen again?
The funeral they held out there above the hay fields was simple but profound. Falcon McAllister stood apart from the crowd, hearing Cassius Barlow say words for his granddaughter that Falcon wished he had known how to say for those little girls he'd found months ago up on the high plains of Colorado.
Maybe there's a reason why the Lord tolerates the kind of man that could do a thing like this. Maybe he's testing our patience. Testing our souls, that the good book says should be full of forgiveness. Or maybe he has another reason for letting such things happen.
Cassius raised his face to heaven for a moment, his eyes tight shut. Then he gazed around at them, one by one. There was no sting in the gaze that singled out McAllister, nor any hint of blame. But Falcon felt a pang of guilt. This didn't have to happen. He had known for weeks who the woman butcher was and where to find him, and yet he had held back. At first, it was his wounds that delayed him, then that stubborn will not to settle for just one or two of the gang. He had to get to them all.
Maybe the good Lord just wants to see how much pure meanness we, who are made in His image, will tolerate before we let loose our God-given outrage and put an end to it. Killing is killing. What was done to the dear young soul we have to bury now just never should have happened. Not to her. Not to her, dear Lord. And not to anyone.
Falcon's thoughts were dark.
I've been selfish. I came upon an atrocity and set out to make amends because it gave me a thing to hang on to. A purpose where there was no purpose. Then when the killers were in plain sight, I hesitated. I lingered. I didn't want to put an end to this because then I wouldn't have had a purpose anymore. Was I really out to avenge those people in Colorado? I never even met the Blanchards. But it reminded me of what happened to Marie, and it gave me a purpose. I didn't set out to avenge Dorothy Blanchard and her family. I was trying to make it right about Marie. I was was selfish. Now this is what happened.
Mr. McAllister?
The voice beside Falcon cut through his thoughts, bringing him back to awareness. It was Jubal Mason. Falcon realized that the memoriams were done, and most of the men had wandered away. Only a few neighbors remained, wielding spades and miner's shovels, waiting to fill in the graves. Jubal stood facing him, an arm's length away, and his brothers, Jude and Joshua, were right behind him. It was hard to tell which they were feeling most, grief or anger.
I'm sorry.
We're all sorry. But it wasn't your fault for waiting. If we'd gone after that bunch like we wanted to, we'd have missed the one who did this.
You were right, Mr. McAllister. We need to wipe out that whole rotten bunch like you said. It wasn't your fault for waiting any more than wanting her to come here was Jubal's fault. We know whose fault it is, though, don't we?
Billy Chalice.
Billy Chalice. And that Colonel DeWitt, whoever put them up to this land swindle in the first place.
They all killed Becky and her brothers. Like you said, it was all of them. Just like they killed our kin up in Colorado. We're going after that bunch, and we aim to get them all, just like you said.
Parker.
They all looked around. A little man who had come in with McAllister was there, holding his derby hat in both hands.
I guess you already know it, but the name isn't Colonel DeWitt. It's Asa Parker. He uses a lot of names, and he's fooled a lot of people, but he's Asa Parker.
This is Mr. Wiley. He's with the Kansas Pacific Railroad. Tell him what you told me, Wiley.
Yes, of course. Asa Parker, who calls himself Colonel DeWitt now, is running a scheme to sell a big piece of the neutral strip to an investment syndicate back east. He's working with a land shark named O'Brien, and they're capitalizing their operation with little swindles, selling plots and sites to settlers, then chasing them out and selling again.
Eastern investors. How do they aim to swing that? Everyone knows the neutral strip is no man's land. These big buyers wouldn't touch it.
You're right. They're not fools. But Parker's gang will offer a plausible title, even though there's no patent on the land. They'll offer quitclaim deeds to property described as eminent domain, sealed and sanctioned by an agency of the U.S. government. Who's going to argue? Especially when they sweeten the pot with documented railroad route for profit.
How can they do that? They got someone in the government?
Exactly. A gentleman named Cipher. Technically, Cipher's a clerk for Jonathan Bowles Stratton, head of the agency that designates rail routes. But Stratton's a lame duck, going out with the present administration. Cipher is running things to suit himself. He has secured forged maps and letters of approval with Stratton's signature on them, indicating railway intent with the right of way right through here. There are even detailed railroad plans, and Stratton's office will verify them. An authenticated trackage means government sanction.
There really going to be a railroad through here? I never believed that.
Probably not. The whole scheme will unravel when it goes before the Senate committee overseeing Stratton's department. But the new investors will have purchased the land by then. Cipher and Asa Parker and the rest will be gone with the money, and only the people swindled will suffer.
Damn! Cipher? Is he the one heading up all this?
He is.
Where is he?
Probably with Asa Parker and O'Brien, over at their town. Paradise, I believe they call it. It was already there when they came. It was called Prosperity, but it wasn't a legal town or anything. Just a little settlement where squatters exchanged their goods.
Well, it's more than that now.
Of course it is. Paradise is a stage. A money trap. Being set up to snare the big investors when they arrive. Parker plans to show them a booming town, a settled community, and a fine site for railroad business. That's where the deal will be made, and the money will be cash transfers to Kansas City and St. Louis banks, not recoverable. It's a real sweet swindle, if you look at it that way.
When are those investors coming?
Well, they're probably on their way now. There was a private conference in St. Louis a month ago that we wondered about. Big money, very quiet. Boston money, mostly. We heard about it from our bankers, but not much. I think it was about Cipher's plan.
Damn! Lordy, where's the law when you need him?
That's what makes it work. There is no law. Not any kind at any level. This is no man's land. A
according to the U.S. Justice Department and the Department of the Interior, there's nothing here. Just a hole in the orderly world of bureaucracy that goes away if you don't recognize it. There's no law here because this strip doesn't exist officially.
Then we'll be our own law. Someone's gotta be. Where's Brett? He knows all about things like this.
He's over at the town. Nobody knows him there, so he comes and goes, listening. He's heard about this by now, I expect. About Becky and all. Probably everyone yonder has. And you know Brett. He's gonna be laying for Billy Chalice now. For Dorothy and for all the rest.
Brett won't stand a chance against Billy Chalice. Brett's good with a gun, but not that good. He's a gentleman. He'll hesitate to kill. Billy Chalice won't.
Then we better be there with him. Now.
Do you boys know what you're up against? Do you have any idea who these people are? Billy Chalice is a lunatic, with posters on him as far away as Illinois. Crazy as a bedbug. But he's also the slickest gun hand this side of Fort Smith, barring maybe Asa Parker himself.
Then we'll have to get at him another way. I don't care whether the son of a bitch is shot or hanged. I just want him on his way to hell, the sooner the better.
If Brett can't bring him down, then who can? You, Mr. McAllister? You still hurting. I see it every time you move. You think you can outdraw a gun slick like that, with those cracked ribs still slowing you down?
Well, maybe not. But maybe I've got more chance than Brett does.
Cassius Barlow hadn't said a word through it all. The old man just listened. His head bowed in thought. Now he squared his shoulders.
Mr. McAllister, I reckon now this business is a Barlow concern.
Huginati had squatted in a cedar clump, as unnoticed as the gray-green fronds around him, and watched Tuck Kelly die. He had been so close that the second bullet through the outlaw sprayed him with crimson drops. Kelly had perched himself up there to ambush the three riders below. Huginati knew the two of them were dead, but the third one, the woman, had been luckier. Twice her rifle had found its target, and then the one called Tuck had lain sprawled on grassy caprock a dozen feet from where Huginati squatted. Huginati had crept to the edge of the caprock and peered over as screams came from below, followed by a single gunshot. The boy had watched for a moment, then drawn back, feeling sick. At that distance, he couldn't see exactly what the man was doing, but who he was doing it to was no longer alive. With a frown, Huginati had raised his rifle, but his hands were unsteady. He turned away, taking deep breaths, willing the sick feeling to pass. When he had returned to the edge of the bluff, the man was gone. Only sprawled, pale limbs and death lay where he had been. Huginati had almost quit then. He'd seen too much of blood and death. But deep in his mind, a spirit had stirred. Didanawai didn't quit. The warriors of the Cherokee were tenacious beyond belief. It was one of the things that had made Didanawai the most feared of men. Among all the true people, the Shawnee and Iroquois of the east, the Cheyenne of the west, the Huron of the north, even the haughty Lakota and all their kin, the Cherokee were revered. With grim determination, the boy had set out afoot toward a canyon a mile away where his horse waited. Then, mounted and ready, he had taken the trail of the white man who butchered women. Within 3 miles, Billy Chalice had known that there was somebody behind him. The bloodlust had consumed him for a time. That wild thrill that always came from hearing the screams of a female had been denied him, and he was wild with anger. There had been no thrill in what followed. Only rage. Over darkening terrain, he pushed his frightened horse until the frenzy in his head died to a feeble trill. With his senses cleared, he had realized he was being followed. He doubled back a couple of times, ridden into a draw, and then whipped his horse until it climbed frantically to the top, giving him a sudden, unexpected view of his backtrack. There had been no movement back there in the dusk, not even a hint, but he had known that someone was there. Now, with animal cunning, he had spurred his horse, breaking into a run. and pummeled its ribs for a fast quarter mile. Chalice swung down, slapped his horse's rump, and watched it skitter off into the darkness. It wouldn't go far. It was too hurt and exhausted. He cut to the right, scrambled to the top of a rise, and lay down to wait. It was dark, and he thought that whoever was back there had probably stopped. But the darkness would pass, and the pursuer would come sooner or later. And Billy Chalice would be waiting. Ujinati slowed his horse to a walk, sniffing the evening breeze. There was water near. He could smell the sweet odor of damp earth, a hint of mud, and the faint stench of tadpoles. Not a creek, probably just a little pond, where rainwater still stood trapped, waiting for hot sun to reduce it to mud flats. Thoughtfully, the boy who was a rattlesnake squinted at the starlight prairies around him. He'd chosen a low place, a little swale between hills. He unsaddled the animal to graze. He made no fire, but ate a little pemmican and drank water from his canteen, then gave water to the horse. Now he would continue on foot. The pond nearby was just as he had thought, a natural tank in a low spot between overhanging caprock ledges. Not a good place to be at night. Every wild thing within miles would come there to drink. Everything with fangs, claws, fur, or scales. It was their place, not his, and he respected that. Beyond the edges, he squatted to smell a sage clump, then another. He found the trail of the man he was following. He stood still, and the rattler slithered off into darkness.
Ujinati, you know me. You are my brother now.
The low prairie between the hills was alive, but Ujinati walked among them secure. He was Didanawa'i, and they knew him. Without realizing it, Ujinati passed within 100 yards of the crest where Billy Chalice lay waiting. Only when he found the man's half-crippled horse, still saddle-bound and standing in a field of fresh grass, did he realize that the man was behind him. The murderer was on that caprock ridge that he had gone around. He was waiting there, in ambush. He worked his way back toward the hilltop. Just where caprock began, Ujinati edged around a cedar thicket, and soft limestone crumbled. His feet went out from under him, and he tumbled, rolling down the incline into moonlight. The boy rolled, dodged, and scrambled to his feet. Something tugged at his jacket. He ran out of the moonlight into dark shadows. Chalk fragments flew around him. A bullet whisked past his ear, and dark talus exploded before him, blinding him. And then suddenly, there was no footing. He fell, rolling and bouncing into deep dark. He was engulfed in pure darkness. Carefully, painfully, he wiped the dust out of his eyes. He was in a dark place, with no light at all except the faint glow of moonlight through a jagged crevice in the stone.
Is this a cave?
He stirred, squinting, trying to see. He felt around for his rifle, but he couldn't find it. He sensed the presence of another creature, so close he could feel its body warmth. He reached out a tentative hand and froze as his fingers touched thick fur. In the patch of moonlight, there was a silhouette. It had wide, alert ears and a wide, furry face. And even in the darkness, he could see the glint of feral eyes and bared fang.
Wolf.
Thrusting fresh loads into his .45, Billy started down the slope, angling toward the ledge. At its edge, he peered downward, but saw nothing, just the jumbled shadows of broken, eroded limestone and the brushy slope below, angling down toward a pool of water. Whoever was down there was hidden by darkness in the night. Scuttling to the right, Billy worked down the taper of the caprock, where the ledge disappeared into hillside slope. 20 feet, then another 20, and the brushy slope was only a few feet below, a weedy darkness beneath the wedge of pale stone. He gauged the distance for a jump.
Shit! Rattlesnake!
Billy backed away. He hated snakes, and it sounded like a whole den of them right there at the base of the rocks. It was full spring, the days were turning hot, and the nights belonged to the Rattlers. He angled farther to the right, stepping carefully, then stepped gingerly to the lower slope and eased down toward the water, going wide around the snakes, but still keeping his eye on the place where the pursuer had fallen. Once he figured he was clear of the snakes, he started up the slope again, heading for that spot. Scours and crevices made the limestone bluff a puzzle of dim shapes and darknesses. Billy jerked upright. Somewhere just ahead, something big lurked, and its growl was so near he could almost smell its hot breath. Plain animal fear washed over Billy. He dodged back.
To hell with this!
Billy turned and ran. Something solid hit his boots, and he felt its writhing tug as he tore free. He sprinted, gained the top of the bluff, and didn't stop there. Whoever was down in that hole, he wasn't worth it. Billy ran, looking to find his horse, to get away. Nobody in Paradise knew that the stages were coming until riders came in from the northeast and reported three fast coaches crossing Wolf Creek at the downstream bend. By the time Asa Parker, Cypher, and O'Brien gathered at the land office, staring out the window, the three stage coaches were close enough to see.
It's them, the syndicate people, my investors. They're here.
How did they get here without you knowing about it? You said they'd meet up with that idiot Stratton at Emporia, and we'd have plenty of word.
I don't know. Maybe they came straight from Wichita. Anyway, they're here. And don't try to blame me, Asa. You've had all spring to nail down this territory. Why aren't you ready?
O'Brien scribbled furiously at papers littering his desk while he squinted at the elaborate tract map hung on the wall.
Jesus Christ, Asa! I mean, Colonel. I don't have titles ready for all the tracts we marked out. Hell, I don't even know for sure which ones have squatters on them.
Shut up! So we got a few squatters down on Rabbit Creek. Fine. Let's just make the best of it. Now get ready to receive paying guests and make it good, O'Brien. This is the one that counts.
The parade into town was by far the most elegant sight ever seen in Paradise. Three ornate Concord stages, each pulled by a six-up hitch and sporting lacquered panels and brass trim, all flanked by riders of a different cut from the rabble that roamed the neutral strip. They stopped in the rutted street between the hotel and the land office, and the dignitaries stepped down, gazing around at the ramshackle little settlement that they had come to judge. Wearing his best St. Louis attire, Asa Parker and Cypher came out to meet the men whose opinions would decide the investment of several million dollars. The man who stepped forward to study him with shrewd, calculating eyes was almost as tall as Parker himself, though far more trim and manicured.
Colonel DeWitt, I presume. I'm John Wigginton, Chief Investment Officer for the Morley Syndicate. We've come to discuss purchase of this, well, whatever it is here that you're offering for sale. Let me introduce the rest of my party, and then perhaps we can rest a bit. I assume you have accommodations for our party.
We'll have the hotel cleared for you very shortly, Mr. Wigginton. We're a bit remiss. We didn't know you were coming just now.
Of course you didn't. The wires are down west of Emporia, and there are no mail routes past Hardwoodville.
My name is Cypher. I suppose you met with Mr. Stratton, and he vouched for me.
He didn't vouch for anyone. The Honorable Mr. Stratton had barricaded himself in a whorehouse at Emporia in a drunken stupor. We decided to proceed and see for ourselves what this Paradise Railhead plan might offer.
Yes, sir. Fortunately, I have all the necessary documents with me, and Mr. O'Brien is prepared to show you the holdings involved. He has a map and charts. I assume you and your party are empowered to take title?
If there is title to be had. This is, of course, undefined territory. We are not interested in buying blue sky, sir. Our investors will require uncontested deeds.
Mr. O'Brien can issue deeds, of course. Deeds of clear title based upon grant of land for railroad development. What could be more secure?
We want to see the actual real estate, of course. And by the way, Mr. Cypher, we passed through some of those unoccupied stairs Mr. O'Brien's literature proclaims. A fair number of them seem quite occupied. There are people on the land, sir. We saw structures being built, fields being plowed, fences raised. Not precisely what we expected. Do you have any comments, Colonel DeWitt?
Squatters. Nothing but trash, squatting on land that isn't theirs. A minor problem. The Paradise Vigilance Committee will tend to them. I guarantee it.
I hope so. We're prepared to invest here, sir, but do not take us for fools. We're aware that without a court of jurisdiction, we're only looking at a railroad site patent and quitclaims. We can live with that. But at final transaction, we'll require some assurance of possession.
And you'll have it.
Wigginton pursed his lips, took another slow look around at the town sprawling around him, and turned to his lead coachman.
Samuel, see to the coaches in the stock, please. I'm sure these gentlemen will direct you to accommodations.
While Cypher escorted the visitors to the hotel, Asa Parker signaled to Casper Wilkerson.
How many men do we have that we can still trust?
Maybe a dozen here in town. A few more riding patrol. Maybe 20 altogether. Vince Colby's took off with the rest. The boys figures he went to stake out that Hay Meadows ranch and maybe get some horses back. Ain't heard from him since.
Goddamn bunch of fiddlefoots. Have someone find Colby and get word to everyone else. I want every man that draws vigilante wages right here in town. Spread them out where they can watch every direction, but keep them clear of the stagecoach people yonder. And tell them to keep their eyes open and their mouths shut. Where's Billy?
He's holed up in one of them horse shacks down in the hog pens. Nobody wants to get near him. You heard the story going around, didn't you? What Billy did to that squatter girl that killed Tuck?
I heard. So what? Everyone knows Billy's crazy. Right now, I need him. So round him up. Make sure he's sober and tell him to stand by. If any of them squatters try to come in, you all know what to do.
Billy won't listen to me.
Well, he'll listen to me. And he'll listen to money. You tell him it's coming on payday. If that doesn't work, tell him he'll either take orders or he'll answer to me, face to face.
What are we gonna do, Asa?
Well, we sure aren't going raiding again. That takes too long. O'Brien's got land titles here in Paradise, and Cypher's got the buyers here. We'll get our deal all right, and once it's signed, those squatters won't own a thing.
They'll know what's going on here. They got plenty of spies right here to tell them.
Do you know who the spies are?
Wilkerson's hooded eyes roved the crowds nearby, pausing momentarily at a well-dressed, dark-haired young man standing alone, pretending not to watch what was going on.
Not rightly. I got some ideas, though. We got one Jasper around here that makes me right itchy. He's always around listening and prying, putting ideas into folks' heads, like going out settling claims of their own, like joining up with squatters.
Tend to him, then. Just don't make a fuss.
I'll do that. The word's still going to get out, though.
Let him try to come in and stop us. We're on our own ground here. We'll bury them in it. Spread the word. There's a bonus of $50 per man if no more squatters get into town alive.
Red Archer was one of a dozen or so tenants evicted from the ramshackle Paradise Hotel to make room for O'Brien's visiting dignitaries. Because the Virginian had become known around town, and because most of the vigilantes were timid about the quiet, quick-eyed young dandy with the low-slung gun, they were polite about it. But it was an eviction. Brad wasn't surprised. He'd seen the stages coming in and been close enough to hear some of what passed when the passengers landed. He had known for some time who had robbed and killed the Blanchard family. He knew all but two of them by sight. For days at a time in the past few weeks, he had watched them. Billy Chalice had been just a name passed around. But now he was here, and Brett knew where he was. He strolled to the dismal pole barn that served as a livery. The place was bustling now with the activity of preparing space for three big Concord stages and feed for their teams. He placed his valise there in the same roped-off corner with his saddle and gear. Then he gentled his horse and tossed the saddle on him. He waited until the livery teams were being unhitched, then led the animal out, trying to attract no attention. Back on the street, he looked southward. Out on the flats, just at the edge of town, was a squalid little settlement of dugout, side-roof sheds, and stained tents. The Hog Pen, some called it. Others referred to it as Boys Town. Once in past times, when the great southern herd was being systematically wiped out, it might have been a buffalo camp. Then some squatter had tried to raise hogs there, giving the place its name. Now it was something else. A squalid little nest of gambling, drinking, and whoring that not even Colonel DeWitt's crude paradise would claim. In the months since paradise had grown, more enterprisers had drifted in from the territories, bringing their whores and their whiskey. There wasn't a thing out at the hog pens that wasn't for sale. Billy Chalice was out there. Brett checked the loads in the revolver, then dropped it back into its holster and let his coat fall over it.
This is for you, Dorothy. I'll see that maniac in hell, or I'll see you in heaven.
From a crude porch across the street from the livery, Casper Wilkerson watched thoughtfully. He didn't care one way or another about the quiet young dude from Virginia. He was only watching him because it kept him in town. Asa had pretty well cleared the streets of vigilantes since the Spenders arrived. A few were holed up here and there, but most were out on the roads to keep the Barlows at bay. Casper didn't want to leave. Of the six who knew of the railroad money in the big wagon, only three were left, and Casper had a notion that Asa Parker didn't intend to share. But now, watching the dude head for the hog pens, intuition told Casper what he was up to. Red Archer was looking for Billy Chalice. He looked around. The town looked almost deserted. Parker and O'Brien were over at the hotel with the land buyers. Here and there, a few drifters moseyed around, and there were men tending stock at the livery. But for once, the main street stood empty, with the big overland wagon standing out there unattended. Besides himself, only Asa and Billy remained of the six. Making up his mind, Casper strode across to the livery.
Saturday big done for me, boy.
He walked on through to the little locked shed beyond, his private quarters by right of possession. And he was back in a minute or two, covered from neck to boots by that long, dark coat of his, now looking more bulky than before. Wilkerson headed south at a slow trot, following the distant figure of the Virginia. In the back of the barn, a shaggy, sweating man was raking fouled hay. He saw Brett ride away, and he saw Wilkerson follow. It might have been simple curiosity that prompted Cass Jolly to follow along, or it might have been something more. Cass had wandered away from paradise for a while after getting crossways with a few of Obermeyer's vigilantes. He'd even thought about staking a claim of his own and trying his hand at the plow. Hunger had brought him back, that and a natural aversion to the lonely, hard work of farming. But he was off the payroll now. Just a little too old to bluster his way back into Asa Parker's crowd, and just a little too slow to think seriously about robbing him. So he had settled for what he could get, a crap wage job in town. Like a lot of men these days, Cass Jolly was in no man's land because he had no other place to go. But lately, Cass had been giving some more serious thought to what Brett Archer had said about starting fresh in a place where the rules hadn't been made yet. Cass set the hay rake aside and dug out his possibles from the dingy loft. Then he slapped his old saddle onto a peaceable little roan that had outlived at least two owners. Out ahead of Cass, Brett Archer was still in sight. And behind Archer, like a buzzard on a big horse keeping to the cuts and washes, rode Casper Wilkerson. Like a spread-out little parade, they all headed for the hog pen south of Paradise. Slanting sunlight cast long shadows as they passed, and none looked back.